From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made in Allentown, Pennsylvania. And you know, we've been living here in Allentown. And they're closing all the factories down. Out in the town of Bethlehem. And they're killing time, filling out forms, and standing in line. And it's getting very hard to stay while we're waiting here in Allentown. It's Billy Joel, right? Let's listen for a second. Allentown. All right, so this is Allentown, Billy Joel, one of his many hit songs. But writing for Slate Magazine Online, Ron Rosenbaum is having none of it. He writes that Billy Joel is the worst pop artist ever. Rosenbaum writes the following, quote, "I am reluctant to pick on Billy Joel. He's been subject to withering contempt from hipster types for so long that it no longer seems worth the time. Still, the mystery persists. How can he be so bad and yet so popular for so long? And it got me thinking about the question of value in art and whether there are any absolute standards for judging it. It indicates the question is still alive, not relegated to irrelevance by relativism." End quote. And so that left us at Connections with two things to think about. The first is rather narrow. Is Billy Joel really that bad? Come on. After all, we didn't start the fire. It was always burning, and the world was turning. Beyond that, what about Rosenbaum's idea that we have to be willing to call out bad art to establish a baseline for appreciating art when it is good, or great, or profound? Rosenbaum does not buy the idea that there is no good or bad, there's just what you like and what you don't like. He says that in any genre of art, there is a baseline of quality. Is that true? Let's talk about that. My guests include John Kovach, director of the Institute for Popular Music at the University of Rochester. Welcome back, John.
Thanks, Evan. Great to be here.
And Leah Stacey is a media professor at Nazareth College and a freelance theater critic at City Newspaper. Leah, welcome to you as well.
Thank you.
And Randy Gorbman has been to how many Billy Joel concerts?
I've been to none. However, may I speak out on behalf of balding Jewish men from New York City?
Yes.
And say that
yes.
I was reading that review, and I really think it was too harsh.
I think it was a little over the top.
I do like Billy Joel. I haven't gone to his concerts.
I have a problem with Billy Joel. No, I don't.
He's a pop guy.
Yeah.
We're not talking deep art here.
Hey, hang on a minute.
Oh. I'm going to leave before John starts berating me for this.
Okay. So why are you here?
I am here actually because we have not only the more serious subjects like we did last hour, of course, and great research about the Great Lakes and what's going on with the high lake levels, but also a lot of arts and cultural items and a lot of fun fare, but things that all, again, take resources to put on. And we need your help. This is the end of our pledge drive. We end up later this afternoon. We still have a long ways to go. If you could please do anything you can to support the kind of programming. If you enjoy this, whether you're a Billy Joel fan, whether you're not, if you don't want to hear it again, maybe make a donation. Say, don't ever play that again. 454-6300. That's 454-6300. 1-800-295-9994. 1-800-295-9994. Or you can make a donation at WXXINews.org or WEOS.org. Whatever you can do, please support public broadcasting and your hometown station, WXXI, and of course, WEOS.
Thank you, Randy Gorbman.
Okay.
Go back and listen to your Billy Joel in the office there. So here's the deal. John Kovach, I'm going to start with you. Because I want to spend most of this hour on, what is the more interesting question, which is whether we have to be willing to say when things are bad to understand when they are good, or if that's over the top and music and art of any kind is subjective. But he's really harsh on Billy Joel. I mean,
yeah.
You know, did you agree with Randy? Was that over the top on Billy Joel?
Well, I mean, look, we all have our opinions, and this is exactly the kind of thing that Rosenbaum would object to what I'm about to say, which is, you know, everybody's got an opinion; they have a right to it. You know, you go to a ball game, you buy a ticket, you got a right to call the pitcher a bum. You know, I mean, and you buy a CD or you don't buy it and have it on your computer some other kind of way. You know, as a fan, you've got a right to like things and to dislike them. But if you're going to, I mean, the funny thing about Rosenbaum's piece, and again, this is from a few years ago, this piece of his, but I don't expect, given the severity of his judgment, he's changed his mind.
No, we've been in touch with him this week. He's not changed.
Really, really. So he still doesn't like Billy Joel.
No, but yeah. He says he's gotten plenty of blowback from the Billy Joel fans out there.
But I think he's got a perfect right to that opinion. But I'm not quite sure he establishes much of a set of criterion for establishing good and bad. He mostly just complains about the lyrics.
Yeah, that's the fascinating thing here. And we're going to touch on that in just a second because, look, it's Friday. Let's get in the weeds a little on Billy Joel music. Let's have a little fun. And then we'll talk about the broader question of art. But John's right here. There is an inconsistency. And we invited Ron to come on the program, and he declined. He said the piece speaks for itself. If it does, what the piece is saying is that maybe there's two separate things. Go ahead and like what you like. Mm-hmm. Drink the wine you want to drink. Look at the art you want to look at. Own it. Buy it. Listen to the music you want to listen to. But then, if we're going to get critical, understand that we are going to need quality bass lines here. Yeah. And he's setting Billy Joel as the bottom. The problem, though, you're right, is part of that quality bass line is much more based on what he views as, you know, lyrics that are problematic,
yeah,
as opposed
that's
to composition,
you know,
of songs.
He's a journalist. He's a words guy. Those are the kinds of things he goes for. You know, I posted that on my Facebook page that I was going to be with you today talking about this. Already a couple of my musician friends, you know, these are like fantastic musicians,
yeah,
you know, who are basically saying, I don't understand this guy's take on Billy Joel at all. I think his music is wonderful. And so, you know, different people are going to look for different things in the music. That's fine. I think the one way in which, I mean, because I don't want to criticize Ron for sounding off on this, because I think his job as a journalist is different than my job as a scholar or, you know, as a historian. His job is really to express his opinion in a kind of a sharp way that's going to prompt discussion. And he's done so.
He sure has.
Because here we sit. So from that point of view, that's really his role. I mean, I'm not so sure it's right to say it's his role to decide what constitutes good and bad art, good and bad pop, good and bad songwriting. He's got his opinion. That's fantastic. But I think what I take away from it is he thinks there should be a sense that things are good and bad and that everything shouldn't just be okay, hey, whatever. And to a certain extent, most of us scholars, most of us music historians, music theorists, intellectuals, you know, we make our money trying to tell people what we think the good stuff is and directing them toward it, and basically tell them that they don't really need to worry so much about the stuff that's not as good. Maybe our opinions are a little bit more broadly cast, but still, ultimately, that's the job. Nobody wants to take a class for a music professor who says, well, basically, it's all about the same and all good. Just listen to what you like.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. All right, Leah Stacey, mm-hmm. Two questions. I'll start with this. Is Billy Joel that bad?
All right, so I think that I would be classified by some people as one of those hipster types who would expect to criticize him and maybe not like him, but I got to tell you, my dad plays the guitar and the piano, and I grew up listening to him play Billy Joel. And so for me, it has a very nostalgic connection.
Mm-hmm.
And so I've never hated Billy Joel. Actually, when I hear it, it brings me back to some really happy times. So I know that's probably not the answer maybe you were looking
for.
No,
but for you, he's fine, right?
Yeah, for me, I've never been bothered by him.
I mean, Nickelback exists, and we're still doing
now
Billy Joel is the worst.
Me.
We know what the worst is. We've got it. I don't know why we're doing this. Anyway, broader question then, which we're going to spend more time on later. What do you make of the premise, though, that Ron Rosenbaum touches on, which is, in art, you know, we got to know what's bad. We have to say what's bad. Not everything is good. If everything's good, then nothing is good. What do you think?
I do agree with that, actually. And maybe I'm on the harsher side of this argument, but, you know, as a critic and somebody who went through training to be a critic, and mine is more specifically in theater, not in music, but music is certainly part of theater. And I think that, yes, we do have to set standards. I think critics are given the responsibility to set those standards a lot of the time. And it's an interesting conversation, especially in a city of this size, when you are the critic of people you see in Wegmans.
Yes. I was going to ask you if it's hard to be critical. It's hard to write sharp lines at times.
Absolutely. Yeah, it is hard. But again, I take that responsibility very seriously. And I think that on the theater side of things, like, we have this very vibrant scene, and if we are not sort of doing our duty on the criticism side of things and, you know, calling out those artistic things that we really think they could, it's not that we don't think they're capable. We think that they need to step it up because we know they are capable.
Yeah. So in other words, if every play you reviewed was good, then why would I think that anything is good?
Nobody would read my reviews.
All right, so before I jump on the phones here, Bob and Pittsford, hang there for a second. Let's just flesh out a little bit of the argument. A little bit of the argument that Rosenbaum makes that John Kovach was touching on. Why does he think Billy Joel is that bad? He bought the entire collection of Billy Joel music, listened straight through, and he figured it out. He says Billy Joel's music has one common thread, and that's contempt for anyone who's not Billy Joel. Contempt for the Catholic Church, contempt for the working man, contempt for parents, contempt for kids, contempt for everybody. And he points to songs like this. It's Still Rock and Roll to Me. He says, listen to the contempt that just drips out of this song. Let's listen a little bit. How about a pair of pink sidewinders and a bright orange pair of pants? Well, you could really be a Beau Brummel, baby, if you just give it half a chance. Don't waste your money on a new set of speakers. You get more mileage from a cheap pair of sneakers. Next phase, new way, dance crazy. Anyways, it's still rock and roll to me. All right, so the argument Rosenbaum makes here is this is a perfect example. He spends the whole song making fun of what people wear, what's in style, what's trendy, white wall tires, all the things that are cool, because Billy Joel is wise enough to realize that those things don't matter, and it's only the fools who are chasing those fashion trends, and it's contempt, contempt, contempt. John Kovach, fair or not?
I bet he loves Dylan, though.
Yeah, I think he does, based
on... George Harrison? I mean, come on. Come on. You are going to criticize a songwriter for complaining about the status quo or superficiality in culture. Why don't you just go after Mick Jagger for I Can't Get No Satisfaction? Ron is a great journalist, but it's just absurd.
But let's establish this. He's not on the program here. He is an amazing writer. I mean, I've read some of his stuff, plenty of his stuff. Even just that piece, he can write circles around me, and he's clearly a great thinker. But John's here to disagree with this point.
Well, but again, I think he's got a perfect right to that opinion. He doesn't like this music, and it's not just this song. I think he makes the point in the article that it's the sort of cumulative power of so many different instances that kind of irritate.
Piano Man. He says Piano Man's a perfect example, which we'll listen to a bit here. He says, this is a guy literally playing piano at a bar who's got contempt for anybody who comes into the bar. They're all losers. Everyone's a loser except for the guy who's named Billy Joel. That's what Rosenbaum's comment about Piano Man is. So listen a little bit here. The regular crowd shuffles in. There's an old man sitting next to me, making love to his tonic and gin. Everybody knows this song, and as he goes throughout the song, Rosenbaum's point is this is a guy who's just, you know, looking down his nose at everybody. But I'm sort of with you, John Kovach. What are the point of lyrics if not to express opinions and ideas about the world, sometimes about things that we think ought to change about the world? What do you think?
Well, I mean, look, there are a lot of cranky figures in literature and art. I mean, Dostoevsky's pretty dark a lot of the time, and most of his criticisms have to do with things that were happening in Russian culture in the late 19th century. And I'm not comparing Billy Joel to Dostoevsky. I'm just saying that Ron's the one who brought up the idea of art. Right, he's the one who said good and bad art, and then he goes to Billy Joel. Well, I mean, there are a couple of probably unexamined assumptions. Although he doesn't have the space to sort of fill all this out. It would take a book, it would take a chapter. But you know, the idea is that first of all, a lot of people wouldn't think of pop music as art. Now, I think that the notion of art anyway here is misplaced and is a social construction that has probably in many ways outlived its usefulness. But if then you talk about this as being good art or bad art, then it comes down to, is there such thing as greatness in music? And is this music great? And the problem with the concept of greatness in music is that once you say that something is great, you no longer are allowing yourself liberty to be critical of it. So who's going to say, oh, you know, Bach, St. Matthew Passion, that was kind of a good piece. But you know, what's always bugged me about it? I mean, it's considered greatness, and so you don't really have the opportunity to critique it. And so, I mean, I think a lot of what he's applying here are ideas that are maybe taken over from high art and culture and then applied to pop music. And then in some ways, figures in pop music are found as wanting. And I just think it's worth examining whether this whole notion of art and greatness is really even the appropriate discourse. Not saying that the music isn't great, but to say that greatness is the wrong question. You know, art is sort of the wrong question. The question is really, if you hear a piece of music, what kind of questions and interesting issues does it raise for you? How rich is the context in which you can place it? And if the context is a negative one or hardly any context, you're going to say, I don't find it very interesting. But if it ties in a number of different kinds of ways, you do find it interesting. So that very song, it's still rock and roll to me. You know, I was alive in 1977, 78, playing in bands. I remember when the new wave guys came along, thinking they were better and hipper than everybody with their narrow ties and their short haircuts and their hipster sort of thing. And that's exactly who he's critiquing. And when I was 19 years old, I was with him all the way. He was speaking for me and a whole generation of rock and rollers who hated these phony posers. You know? And so it's like, well, okay, well, Ron, that song might irritate you, but I'll tell you what, the people he's writing it about, they irritated the heck out of me.
But John, I also hear in your critique here the idea that instead of just trying to figure out what's great or what equals greatness, ask what's the value, what do we get out of the lyrics, what's the richness. It's the same thing in wine, where people get offended by every wine has to have a point score, as opposed to saying, does it reflect a place? Is it meaningful? How does a 40-year-old wine that's barely hanging on but has sentimental meaning, why are we crassly putting a point score instead of saying, does this have value or sentimental meaning to you? That's the same kind of debate about, instead of saying, right, this is great, this is 98 points, this is great, this is not great, as opposed to looking at it through a different lens. Yes?
Yeah, and I would say, I hasten to add to all of this that with regard to Ron, and if he happens to listen or listen later to the podcast or whatever, I relish the debate. And respect the other side. So, in other words, I love to dig into these issues, and I'm grateful that he's raised them.
Yeah. Well, let's turn to Leah Stacey for the other part of Rosenbaum's critique. Let me go back to Allentown, because the separate critique is authenticity. So here's Allentown. It's about the working man. All right, so I'm just going to say, first of all, I like this song a lot. I've always liked this song. But Rosenbaum's point about this kind of stuff, this song, Downeaster Alexa, is that he hasn't earned the authenticity to be the voice of the working man. That this is a Long Island gentrified guy that really, this is the voice of the Allentown workers who were laid off. This is the voice of the fishermen on Long Island Sound. He hasn't earned that. It's not authentic. He doesn't buy it. He doesn't like it. First of all, does that authenticity, does it matter in the voice of the artist? Can you write about things that you haven't directly experienced, whether it's in music or a playwright writing about things? We talked to a playwright yesterday of Other Than Honorable, which you reviewed, a lovely review for City Newspaper, and really liked. And that was a playwright who was not in the military, didn't experience sexual assault in the military, but did a lot of research to understand it. So Rosenbaum is saying, look, that is not an authentic voice of the working man. Come on, I don't buy it. What do you think?
Well, who's going to give the working man that platform? Billy Joel has the platform. And I think part of the thing that this writer misses is that really Billy Joel is a great storyteller. And a lot of the stories are true. And to put him in this box of this is his opinion and he is, you know, just this pompous guy sitting behind a piano, I don't know. Aren't we underestimating him a little bit with that? I mean, he's a storyteller. His lyrics tell stories. I mean, you picture what's happening in his songs when you listen to them, because he has that way with words. Mm-hmm. And I think that to me is always more what I've gotten out of his music. And, you know, when I go and review a show like Other Than Honorable, I am thinking like, In terms of when I'm listening to someone deliver a line, I'm thinking somebody wrote this line. Somebody thought about the way that this was going to come together on stage. And they had to, I mean, that's so difficult to do, to tell that story. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I think we're missing part of that in this piece, is that Billy Joel is a storyteller. And artists tell history. I mean, we go back in history. We look at art. We look at what was happening in art, in regard to politics, to shaping culture, I mean, without art, we lose a great sense of our identity. Mm-hmm. And so I think he, in a way, is telling, I mean, I loved what you were saying, because you were talking about how you were alive and you were thinking about, you were on his side with those issues. And let's be honest, people make everything about themselves, right? That's what we do.
I know I do.
Yeah, no, me too. When I go sit at a play, I'm thinking like, you know, what's this? How is this making me feel?
Yeah.
What issues do I mean, I almost always have to sleep on a review before I finish writing it, because I have to work out, like, how did it make me feel? Can I separate my personal bias with what I actually saw on stage, like the actual, maybe the technical aspects or mm-hmm. something like that? So, yeah, I think Billy Joel is an expert at letting people listen to his songs and make them about their experience in one way or another.
Which... John, you want to add to that before I jump on the phones here?
Yeah, I mean, I guess another thing that what you're saying brings up is this whole notion of authenticity. When I teach, well, 10 years ago, maybe it doesn't work so much anymore, but 10, 20 years ago when I was teaching my history of rock class, when I raised this idea of authenticity in an artist, I say to the students, you know, if it turned out that Bruce Springsteen is not really the guy he seems to be from singing those songs,
yeah.
kind of like Eddie Murphy playing Gumby or the beginning of Roger Rabbit. There's all these sort of comedic things where all of a sudden the character is revealed to be exactly the opposite. If that happened, would those Bruce Springsteen songs be less meaningful to you? And the first thing the students would say, well, it's a hypothetical and he really is that way. But even if he wasn't, and so you realize that, yes, it
matters
absolutely
to
them. Crucial
yeah. okay.
that, and but all of these images, authenticity is always a construct of the entertainment business. It is not unlike Mark Hamill playing Luke Skywalker there. It's mm-hmm. obvious we don't expect him to actually have a lightsaber, right? But with all performers, it's a matter of putting on, you cannot have an image without working to project it. If you don't work to project it, you just look like an amateur, you know? And so somebody like Bruce Springsteen is very much working to project the Bruce Springsteen image. It may be consistent with who he is. It may be consistent with part of who he is, but there may be other parts that aren't consistent with it. And so the idea that Billy Joel cannot also don a mask and sort of play a role is really against most of the way the entertainment business works. I mean, nobody has any problem with Meryl Streep playing characters that are nothing like who she is, you know, or Glenn Close. I just saw Sunset Boulevard. That's the on Broadway. And you know, I'll bet you Glenn Close is nothing like the character she played. What right does she have to play an aging Hollywood actress? She is actually kind of an aging Hollywood actress. But nevertheless, she's not down on her luck. That's for sure, because she's playing Broadway. I mean, the more you start to think about it, the more it starts to get a little bit absurd.
But I go back to what Leah Stacey was saying about the fact that Billy Joel is clearly a storyteller in his music. If every one of his albums, or most of them, or the majority of his songs were about the working class, or kind of writing about himself, Allentown, he's writing about the workers. Bruce Springsteen is writing about the river, his own life, that album in particular, and those kinds of experience. If Billy Joel, if the majority of it was that, and it wasn't pockmarked with Piano Man, Say Goodbye to Hollywood, you know, this sort of rangy stuff that kind of hits different themes, then maybe you would look at that and say, come on, dude, you're the dirt under your fingernails guy. But Allentown and Downeaster Alexa, you'd have to pick them out, because most of his music is not about those themes. So I guess where I'm going with that, Leah, is that to me says he's clearly a storyteller.
Yeah.
He's not just one theme guy faking it.
Yeah, well, think about the writers that exist in the world today. There's some people who write memoirs, and there's, you know, maybe that's the Bruce Springsteen type of writer. And then there's people who write short story collections, and maybe that's more what Billy Joel would be classified as.
Yeah. I mean, for me, Billy Joel, and now I'll say the things I don't like about Billy Joel. I think that where he shows both his strength and perhaps a certain kind of weakness in a certain kind of way as an artist, maybe strength as a songwriter, but maybe weakness as an artist, is that he's such a chameleon. And he's fantastic at adopting the styles of other people, changing them just enough that it doesn't seem like he's totally ripping them off, although Ron does in a couple cases think that he is. I don't think that he does. But he has this wide range. It's like what Billy Joel likes to be most is the songwriter and the singer. And he's in the sense of songwriters going all the way back to the Brill Building and Tin Pan Alley and all of that, he writes songs on a wide variety of different topics using a wide variety of different styles because he enjoys the art of songwriting. And he enjoys, I think, performing those songs, and he's a fantastic singer and a wonderful pianist. But is there then a kind of a single artist behind all of it that we can relate each song to that artist's own biography and personal experience? Is he meaningful in that way? Maybe not. But I'm not so sure there is in the case of George and Ira Gershwin or Cole Porter either, really. I mean, he's a songwriter who performs his own work. So putting him through the Bruce Springsteen lens and saying, well, it's different. Well, all you know now is it's different. But is it good or bad because of that? Well, I think that's a much richer discussion.
After our break, Bob in Pittsburgh, Rick in Rochester, you're first up right after the break. And as I go to our only break of the hour, a little bit of irony here. Is that Billy Joel, I think his last album was River of Dreams, 1993-ish, and I don't think he has done a single other album since because he kind of doesn't want to. Well, you know what he plays a lot of? Classical music. He's a really good piano player, and if you go hang out at his house, and I haven't done it, but I've read New Yorker pieces about it, that's what he's playing. So he's actually, you know, he's got a little bit more talent than three chords. He's not Nickelback on a piano. Okay, so when we in our second half hour, we're going to ask our guests, especially John Kovach, besides Nickelback, who really is the worst, and we are going to talk more broadly about just, you know, how we evaluate art and whether we're sort of doing it right or doing it wrong, and whether we need that baseline of bad to understand what good is. You want to call the program 844-295-TALK, toll free 844-295-8255 or 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester, 263-9994. We're right back. I'm Evan Dawson. Monday on The Next Connections, New Yorkers Against Gun Violence says a funny thing happened recently. With the election of Donald Trump, they've seen more progress in getting their legislative agenda passed. Why is that? Well, they'll explain and they'll tell us what their 2017 legislative agenda is, how they want to protect children and families. We talked to New Yorkers Against Gun Violence on Monday. Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our guests include John Kovach, the director of the Institute for Popular Music at the University of Rochester, and Leah Stacey, a media professor at Nazareth College and a freelance theater critic at City Newspaper. And Randy Gorbman, if you were a super fan of any band, what would it be?
Wow, that's a really tough question.
You get one concert. What's it going to be?
You know, I've never seen the Stones in all these years, and they're still playing in some fashion. So
yeah.
I guess they still sound great. I haven't seen them for, you know, ever. Except on
video. So that would be at the top of your
that
list.
That would be right now, just, you know, somebody who I hadn't seen before. Yeah, I've seen Springsteen a few times. He's
great. I'll tell you one I haven't seen that I hear never misses a note. One of the best live singers in history is James Taylor.
He's fantastic.
I saw him a couple times back in the day, as they say.
That would be on my list. But we digress. We are in the middle of a dollar-for-dollar challenge right now, and this is the final day of our spring membership campaign.
And Dee Mosteller, thank you to Dee, of course, a big supporter of WXXI. So you're basically doubling your money, whatever you can give today to WXXI to help us with the pledge drive and support great programming like Connections. I mean, you hear Evan on for a couple of hours a day, and of course, you know, he works with his producer, Megan Mack, and other people in the newsroom, but there's so much preparation and so much infrastructure that goes on behind the show and in terms of doing the live broadcast, everything else that we do during the year, not to mention what WXXI News tries to do. You heard last hour, Great Lakes Today, that all costs money in terms of equipment, personnel. We have a lot of great plans for the coming year. You know, budget time is coming up here, and of course, I'm making my wish list, but, you know, the bosses tell me, you know, well, Randy, we have X number of dollars to spend, and I'd like them to say we have a little more this year because we made our pledge drives, and we only have a few hours left for that. You can do that by making a call right now, whatever amount of money you can donate, to 454-6300, 454-6300, or 1-800-295-9994, 1-800-295-9994, or just go to WXXINews.org or WEOS.org, and whatever you can do, we'll continue great programming, and you can, too, become a big shot like what you're hearing right now.
Big shot. I like it.
Okay.
You can say goodbye to Hollywood and just stay right here with us, Randy. There you go. I want to grab a couple of phone calls. Several have been waiting for a while to jump into the conversation. Bob in Pittsburgh. Go ahead, Bob.
Hi, good afternoon. I think the irony here is it's basically an opinion column saying people shouldn't have an opinion. And the problem also is, in many ways, art is opinion.
Okay.
So to say you can't have an opinion, I mean, I think it's bad to I can understand some things may be deemed not good art. But to create a box and say only the things inside that box are good and everything outside that box is bad, I don't think that's how art should work.
Well, what do you think? John Kovacs, start with you.
Again, I think the discussion about what's good and bad is what's productive, not the conclusions, you know. That I guess that would fall into the kind of relativism that that Ron is critiquing. I think a friendly amendment to your statement would be it's an opinion piece, trying to say we should get beyond opinion, but then doing so by using opinion to justify it. And so that to me is the irony. But again, I value the discussion, and I think it would be a bad place if we didn't argue about good and bad. That's part of what makes the arts vibrant is the back and forth about what we like and what we don't like and why. And that changes over the years. You know, as a historian, you can see that over the course of a couple of hundred years, even in classical music where we think we have the greats established, those greats have changed a number of times over the last couple of hundred years. And so, and who we think is great in pop music will change 50 years from now. We might, if we could come back and look, we might say, gosh, I can't, how could they possibly say that that's not the way it was at all? But that's the nature of these things.
Leah, what do you think?
Can I just say this is why I love artists, first of all, because we talk about this stuff, because we care about it. I think for me, there are some absolute standards, and I'll use an extreme example. But if I go to a show and somebody doesn't know their lines or know the lyrics,
that's a competency standard, yeah.
Yeah, so there have to be some things, but that is, you know, part of the overall art that they're presenting. Right. Mm-hmm. So maybe it varies from, you know, different parts of art.
Yeah. And I think some of us that are on the inside, I mean, that perform a lot and go to a lot of performances, we tend to value performers for the performance aspect of what they do. So, for example, I can think that I can imagine a performance is great. For example, Sunset Boulevard is a fantastic show because Glenn Close is. There are moments in that show where you say, this is what greatness is. Not that it's a great show, that she's great, but there's a moment where there are moments where greatness truly shines through. The show, I think, is kind of mediocre as a show, but greatness can shine through from the sheer mastery of a performance move. And we've all had those kind of tingly feelings where we've seen something happen on stage and we've gone, oh man, this is it. This is as good as this gets.
Yeah, but I've also looked around at those moments where I'm having that, and there's somebody asleep, like a row away.
Or unwrapping a mint or a candy or something.
Oh my gosh, don't even get me started.
Let me ask Bob if he wants to follow up there. Go ahead, Bob.
Well, you mentioned earlier about Billy Joel being able to almost put on different masks and perform different things. And to me, that is art. And, you know, if you look at David Bowie and all the different phases, and even, you know, U2 and the changing of his persona on stage, that I think that's all kind of part of it. And I think I like those guys, and I know there are a lot of people who don't like those guys, but it's not just because the person who has an opinion that it's not good art doesn't necessarily mean it's not good, and the person who says it's good art doesn't necessarily mean it's good.
Well, if we're talking about an objective set of reasons, though, and I think one of the criticisms that John Kovacs had for the Rosenbaum piece was, apart from the lyrics and this idea of authenticity, which we've been kind of talking about, or this idea of contempt as a theme, there isn't really an objective set of standards for us to look at that and say, well, that's the worst pop artist of all time. Mm-hmm. You know, whereas Nickelback's never played more than three chords. So, you know, that's sort of the thing. But Bob, let me just kind of throw this back to you to kind of support what you're saying. You talk about kind of this either a jack of all trades or somebody doing different things. DP on Twitter says, Billy Joel's not a Vietnam vet, but many vets have felt Goodnight Saigon speaks strongly for them. Yeah. Powerful song, you know, so who's to say that's not authentic? What do you think, Bob?
Bruce Springsteen's not a Vietnam vet either, but back in the USA is...
Born in the USA.
Born in the USA is considered a kind of an anthem.
Agree with that, Bob?
I do, and I think it goes back to the point that was made. I don't remember her name, but a Vietnam vet, if he were a singer instead, wouldn't be... I mean, maybe he could be a Vietnam vet, but the reason that these guys can sing about it and we know about it is because we know who they are.
Well,
just somebody who's gone through an experience who is not a musician and maybe not artistic and can't provide a platform for us to understand what they went through, they would need somebody like a Bruce Springsteen or a Billy Joel or whomever to tell their story for them. And I think that goes a lot farther than, you know, somebody who can't, who has been through that experience but can't portray it.
Well, that's right. There is a craft of songwriting. And if you limit the subset of people who can possibly write a song to people who've actually had that experience and have the skill to write a good song about it, you're really coming down to just like a very few people in the world. I mean, that's what songwriting is. I mean, whatever you want to say about Billy Joel, he is a fantastic songwriter. And competent? My Lord. I mean, he is, I mean, maybe, you know, having been in the music business myself for 40 or 50 years or whatever it is, I mean, I can't tell you how many bad songs I've heard from people who, you know, are earnest and good musicians and trying real hard. We take it for granted that the stuff that we hear most of the time is already been filtered out. The 99% of it that's really horrible and by anybody's objective standard, we don't hear. And so then we start scrutinizing the 1% that made it through, trying to look for what's good and what's bad, when most of what's bad's already been eliminated from our awareness, unless we go to a lot of indie clubs and buy a lot of music on the internet.
That's a very good point. And by the way, Bob, the woman who made that point is Leah Stacey, and she is a theater critic for City Newspaper, where you can read her work. In fact, she's got another review coming soon for that. So it's a great place to read Leah's work if you're not a student of hers, of media at Nazareth College. Before I jump back to your phone calls, a few comments have come in online. Actually, a pile have come in online. Dr. Lou Papa says, I'm a Long Islander. I'm a huge Billy Joel fan. Rosenbaum did this for PR. Billy Joel's still going to be packing him in love, and he's going to be forgotten next week. Okay, Lou, I gotcha. DP says, nothing in Rosenbaum's piece is based on anything but personal preference. There's nothing objective about good and bad art in his piece. He's unable to see many Joel songs as narrated, not confessional. Mm-hmm. So that's a distinction that Leah Stacey was making. But then we've got Colin saying on Twitter, I think the issue is that many people do not like to admit that they like bad music. That's an interesting idea, because I will admit, I will cop to liking some bad music. I've got Kenny Loggins playing with the boys on my running mix. I just said that into a microphone with a lot of people listening. Mm. That is not a great song, but I like it when I run. So John Kovach, you know, are we scared to admit we like bad music?
Well, I'm not guilty about anything I listen to. And in fact, I take a certain point of pride in arguing for people who were overlooked. I'll argue for Pat Boone and the Monkees if you want me to.
Okay. Leah Stacey, any guilty pleasures to music for you there?
Well, I have the same thing when I run. I listen to like very heavy rap because that's the only thing that gets me through running. But there have been times when I will have Top 40 on in my car, and I'll actually switch it depending on who's getting in the car with me, because I know that they're like only listening to folk, indie. And again, this goes back to me being classified as one of those hipster types.
All right. Well, let me grab another one of your phone calls. And Rick in Rochester next. Go ahead, Rick.
Hi. How you guys doing?
Good.
The best concert I've ever saw, and I've seen dozens upon dozens, is Billy Joel and Elton John at Rich Stadium. Hmm. They played for 4 hours straight. There was no breaks. They played each other's music. They played together, and they played their own music. My kids, we have three children, and they're all just about in their 30s now. When they were growing up, they listened to my music. And you know what they listen to now? My music, which is the music that I grew up with in the 70s. That music's not going anywhere. That's the basis of just about everything. The vast majority of the music today, I take it or leave it. I don't. There's not a lot that really turns me on. But when he makes an example of, you know, Billy Joel is not a representation of Working Man with Allentown. Well, is Rush with Working Man? Mm. I mean, Neil Peart got his PhD in music, for Christ's sakes. Excuse me. But that's the deal. I mean, these people are artists. Is anybody who writes a fictional novel, are they a poser too?
Okay, well, let me jump in. Thank you, Rick, for the phone call. Leah Stacey, on this point, I know we've been kind of touching on whether we should limit to personal experience what we write about, whether it's in music, whether it's on stage, whether it's in a book. But there have been times, and I probably could find a few examples pretty quickly if I just used the Google, to figure out authors who took some flack for writing about some really sensitive subjects that did not impact them. Mm-hmm. Sexual assault, those mm-hmm. kinds of things. We have seen those kind of controversies where the critics say, that's not your experience. Mm-hmm. And you shouldn't be embodying that voice in your art if that's not your experience. Do we draw the line anywhere on that? I mean, are there certain things? I mean, certainly race is very, very difficult. I mean, mm-hmm. to write from the perspective of something that is not your experience. Maybe we draw the line at race. Are there places to draw the line when it comes to art and what we're experiencing as either our own? Especially if it seems that it's not just a narrative storytelling type, you know what I mean?
Well, I mean, that's the question of, are we going to limit the documentary journalists and the documentary filmmakers and the people who, you know, go into this sort of, I don't want to say agreement, but collaboration with someone who maybe has experienced that, and they present research-based art, which is, you know, rooted in fact. Mm-hmm. So I, as somebody who really loves that genre, you know, especially with plays, I would be hesitant to limit that.
Right. Yeah, I'd agree. I don't think there should be any lines. People either do things in a compelling way or they don't. And it doesn't really matter whether it's part of their personal experience. That may be interesting biographically, but I think the piece that you're looking at, whether it's a play or a poem or a story or a song, sort of stands on its own merits, irrespective of where it comes from. I mean, if we extended that to scholarship, you know, I wrote a dissertation on 12-tone music in Vienna, but, you know, I'm a white Protestant kid from Livonia, Michigan. Well, I have no right to speak for a Jewish composer who grew up in the late 19th century. That isn't part of my experience and my identity. Well, if we did that, nobody could write about Bach, because I guarantee you, there's nobody still living from 1725. Yeah, except people
Fact.
Maybe sleep all day. So, yeah, but you know, the other thing that's interesting for me here is that the caller mentioned Elton John. You know, Elton John has never written a lyric. All of those lyrics that we see as representing Elton John's voice were written by Bernie Taupin. You know, and the ones
don't
that
ruin this for me. Don't
the,
do
the
this.
Ones that were so it's like, well now Elton John, he's a total poser, because he's pretending to have had all kinds of experiences and emotions that he didn't even really write.
But some people will think that. Do you think he's a poser?
I don't. I think his songs are fantastic. Again, they rise or fall on their own merits and not on some biographical story. Biographical stories are interesting. They create texture and context, and it's wonderful for fans and for scholars to engage in these things. But a piece of music, I think, sort of stands on its own as music and in its relationship to other music, not so much in its relationship to some biography or identity that we write around.
I also think that when things get biographical, sometimes people are too close to them, and it really can muddy the story. I think I've seen some shows where the person, you know, wrote it based on their experience, acted in it, directed it, and I sit there and I think, man, if they had just gotten some other voices in here, some other perspectives, some challenges maybe thrown at them, instead of just, you know, telling the story they remember, this could have been so much
richer.
Richer, that's a great word. Mm-hmm. Yes.
Mike writes to us and says, "We encounter art more often than not through the work of art rather than the artist. We are drawn to a work through some artistic element that speaks to us on a personal level, emotionally, then maybe intellectually. But it is personal first, and it is a work of art first. It does not matter if the author or writer is inauthentic. They are exploring personas and perspectives, and the work stands on its own or not. Is the voice of Holden Caulfield allowed to draw readers in with his cranky persona, but Billy Joel is not? I love John's comment that art discussion is the end in of itself, not the conclusions we might draw." That's from Mike. You know, here's Gary Craig pointing out, he says, Gary Craig on Twitter from the Democratic Chronicle. Hi, Gary. He says,
Gary.
I'd argue that criticism may be unfair about Billy Joel as a pop singer. If dealing in the rock world, he's not in the pantheon. But as a pop singer, he thinks it's unfair. And he says, by the way, Michael Bolton had a career. Well, Gary, my only pushback to that is Michael Bolton is now really self-aware about that and is really good at poking fun at himself. I think Ron Rosenbaum would say Billy Joel had a different kind of career than Michael Bolton, because Michael Bolton was intentionally creating sort of pop radio hit, bubblegum stuff, you know, sort of love songs without much meaning. Billy Joel was aiming to write something of substance, and Rosenbaum's not buying it. That's what I would guess, but I don't know.
Yeah. I mean, it does raise the question about the distinction between the performer and the writer, and realizing that that people who perform their own songs is really something that doesn't really start to become commonplace until Dylan and the Beach Boys and the Beatles in the mid-1960s. I mean, Elvis never wrote a song, Bing Crosby, Fred Astaire, Judy Garland, all fantastic performers who I think touch greatness many times in their performances, as do the songwriters like Irving Berlin and Cole Porter and some of the others I've mentioned who wrote their songs. But it's not the same recipe as this authenticity, this rock authenticity, rockism as it's often called, idea that you know, you have to be the person who wrote your own song, and it has to be about something that happened to you. Mm-hmm. That is so enormously limiting. If you get stuck in that box, it's going to be a lonely place after a while.
Tim in Pittsford says, Nickelback is the worst band ever. That is not opinion. It's pure fact, and anyone who disagrees with that loses all of my respect and should be jailed. That's from Tim in Pittsford. So John Kovach is going to reject the premise of this question because of everything we've talked about, but is there anybody that stands out as objectively bad in music that you just don't really like and you think, come on, guys?
Well, there's a lot of music I don't really like.
Okay, but objectively bad in an artistic style. I think you reject that premise, don't you? Rosenbaum premise.
I don't know. I mean, I there are certainly things that just I find to be not particularly well done. But I guess most of my rejection would have to do with competency issues. When I see somebody that just really can't handle what it is they're trying to do, they're not even coming close to measuring up to what they're trying to do, then I really do kind of dismiss that as not being very good. But most of the time, when I see something that's very competently or expertly executed, I try to give it every benefit of the doubt to sort of meet it on its own terms and not on terms that I decide are the only important ones.
All right, Leah Stacey, two questions as a theater critic then. Is there a play, is there a popular play in the genre that you look at and say, I don't think that's any good, and I think we can set that sort of a baseline for a clunker on stage?
Right now, there's a lot of good theater going on, and I said the word good. But this is a strong time for theater. I think that our political temperatures have actually made our stages hotter, if that makes sense. I'm really excited to see what happens over the next couple of years. There are no contemporary shows that I really have beef with. But I need to add to that. I've been very busy this semester. I haven't made it down to New York in quite a while. And I need to get down there this summer and see some stuff. I have my doubts on some things that are playing.
Any historical shows that, you know, a lot of people go to see but you think are pretty much schlock or...
Oh, I mean, we could have a whole another hour on this, but I'm not a huge Shakespeare fan. I know. Yeah. I know.
And on the other hand, I will admit that I loved Mamma Mia.
Okay.
That's a fantastic musical. If you get in the right spirit,
like,
it's awesome.
What in the world just happened here?
We unraveled. We went rogue.
Oh, my gosh. Okay, so the other question I was going to ask before my brain melted and came out my ears with the Shakespeare thing was this. You said earlier this hour that as a theater critic, you know, John's a historian. You're a critic. You write criticism. Mm-hmm. If you only wrote positive things, your readers wouldn't trust you.
They just wouldn't care.
They wouldn't care.
Who cares about somebody who is a cheerleader for everything?
Right. Okay. So there are some publications, and there's one in this town, and I'm not going to name it out because I think I only know this in confidence, that, for example, will only publish reviews of, I can't even say the genre I'm talking about, if they're good. They will not publish bad reviews. They've had reviewers come back and write reviews of something they did not like that they were reviewing, and they said, we can't do that. So we're only going to do good stuff. The problem is the readership doesn't know that. As a reader of theirs, I don't mind it if they tell me, we send our critics out to a number of different things, and when it's good, we'll publish reviews. Mm. You know, but that's not the contract I have. So if there's more transparency, I can deal. I have an issue with the fact that they're not telling you that. Do you think if you're only going to publish good reviews, do you have a responsibility to your readership to at least let them know when we like it, we'll tell you about it?
Yeah, I guess. And for me, it goes even down to the title. Are they critics or are they just bloggers? There's a difference. And I think if you're using the term critic and you are really trying to push what's happening here and push it to a higher, you know, standard or level, and I don't know, it's important. it's important to really sometimes call things out.
Okay, so let's finish where we started there. Leah, on that question, do we need to know to call out the bad so we can recognize the good, or is that oversimplified?
I'll give you a simple answer. Yes, we do. Because how do things get better? And, you know, maybe that's from competency standards like we've been talking about.
Okay, John Kovach.
Sure, sure. I mean, I just think it's good that that both sides get a chance to address any critique. So if I don't like something, I welcome somebody else coming back and telling me why they do. Or if I don't think something is well done, they tell me why they think it is. Maybe I grow, maybe they grow.
You love the debate, and yeah. You love the conversation. And I think what I'm seeing, and I don't want to read too much into what John has said this hour, but I think one of the reasons that you are at odds with Ron Rosenbaum's piece in Slate about Billy Joel is that it's almost too much of the final word, that Ron's mm-hmm. saying, this is objectively bad, we have to just accept this, and that'll be our baseline, as opposed to saying, can't we talk about this? There's certain
things
that are interesting.
Well, I think we are talking about it. So my sense is that, that Ron, I'm really delighted to hear, you know, how you see this, and I'm really delighted that you brought this issue up. And so we discussed it more, and let's continue.
Okay, well, and Billy Joel lovers out there, please, you don't have to keep flooding our inboxes here. Like, we're sort of down with you. We're all pretty cool with him. It's all right.
Billy Joel is awesome.
I didn't say that.
Are we going to end with a sing-along?
Oh, this is good. I didn't think about... there was the line that I didn't know if it was going to get in there. But the line got in there, but it was in the background, so the FCC is not going to call us. Okay, our thanks to John Kovach, the director of the Institute for Popular Music at the University of Rochester.
I love you just the way you are.
Oh, man. Leah Stacey, you can read her work in City Newspaper. She's a theater critic, a freelance theater critic, and she's also a professor at Nazareth College. Always good, Leah. Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
Great having you here. John Andrus, our engineer today. Thank you, John. Megan Mack, who loves Duran Duran, by the way. If you want to talk about baselines, obviously good. I'm Evan Dawson. Have a great weekend, and we're right back with you Monday.